strange thing has happened, you see, very disturbing. Everything was going so well. They come through a terrible time, then everything is going too well, all comes up roses, everything is happy. And then we're told in the fifth verse of this sixth chapter here, the sixth chapter in Nephi still, that things couldn't be better. There was nothing to keep them from being completely happy, everything. There are no economic, social, any other kinds of problems except in themselves. That was the only trouble. And almost immediately, things started going bad, as you might know, and it tells us. Now, the cause of it was what? We've already seen that now. But in that case, what do you do? Now, isn't that a remarkable parallel to things now? There's no reason in the world, with our technology and resources and so forth, why things shouldn't go very well from now on. But they're not going. They're going to get worse and worse. Well, why should that be? Is that necessary? And what can stop it? See, we have these insoluble problems. On Saturday, someone came down to see me. He was a secretary to a U.S. senator. And he says, do you have any ideas, he says. The men in the Senate are completely at a loss. They realize the drug war is lost. They haven't got a chance. Is there anything we can possibly do? Does anybody have any ideas? He actually came and asked me, of all people. That shows how desperate they are, see? So he just wanted to ask some questions. But how do you solve these problems? Production versus pollution. We have to produce, we have to go on, but we can't do it without polluting. What are you going to do there? See, the essence of tragedy is the incompatibility of two good things, not a bad thing. It's not the black hats and the white hats against each other at all. There's no such in the Book of Mormon. The land of promise, the promise is what? The promise is a blessing and a curse, never mentioned apart. The curse always comes with the blessing. The fact that it's given on this particular land is peculiar to this land doesn't mean we have it sewed up. Yeah, we have it sewed up. We have our choice of being blessed or cursed. But the point is here, again, we have nationalism bursting out everywhere now as against one world. Natural boundaries are disappearing now in terms of pollution and things like that. There are no natural boundaries. It's nationalism, as Brigham Young said, is the principal jewel of Satan's crown. Well, nationalism has burst out anew, and yet against this we have one world. Remember Wendell Willkie's One World? They're both good, but how can you get along together? And when things deadlock. The First Amendment is sacred, but what about pornography? Is there no limit at all to what a person can do and say and display? What are you going to do? The incompatibility of two good things here. So this is what happens. What's the solution? You see, the essence of a Greek tragedy is you have your choice between one thing necessary and another thing necessary. The first Greek tragedy is the Hikateles, the suppliant women, takes place in on the island just off Athens there. And the king of, he has to respect the claims of the 50 Egyptian maidens who were his relatives, who have been raised up in Egypt. And the Egyptians there, they're claimed by Egyptian cousins, but they're not supposed to marry them. And so what's he going to do? Can he yield to the Egyptian threat? And recognize the rights of the Egyptians, or can he yield to the old law of the family and recognize the rights of the girls to marry, not to marry outside the clan, sort of thing. So it's tragedy, and it's the opening words of the king. He has the people all assembled there in the plaza, and he says, Pedes chronenfre, children, we've got to think this thing through. We have to do it, and so it goes. And the classic example of Orestes, remember, whose mother encompassed the murder of his father because he had another lover. What's he going to do? By law, he's required, by the law of the vendetta of the family, he's required to avenge the death of his father, but he's also required not to murder his mother. So what can he do? Well, he solves it, as it should be solved, by going mad. He has no other solution, you see. He does. And he has to be. And so the court of the Areopagus votes on it, the 12 good men and true, the jury, the sacred prehistoric jury in the cave and hill of the Areopagus, they vote on it and split 6-6. They both have their rights, you see. So what do you do then? Well, the only thing that happens is revelation. The only thing that can break it is, in the end, Athena comes down personally. She comes down personally and casts the deciding vote. That's the way we go along with these things. Well, so that's what we have here. It's too warm in here anyway. There. So this tragic dilemma, if any of you have Ecclesiastes here. If you have a Bible here, you just read it, the first chapter of Ecclesiastes. That's the whole thing. He says, we can't win. We're in a non-win situation, is what the wisdom of Solomon tells us, who knew everything, who was the wisest of men. Well, what is the solution? Well, it's in the 20th verse. You've got to have angels come. That's the only thing that'll help you. It's got to come from outside. But it isn't angels here. Men began to be inspired from heaven. And then the question is, were these angels? No. Men can be inspired in heaven without having direct revelations. They can be inspired by heaven, go forth preaching boldly when they see how things are, as far as that goes. Can we count on that solution? Well, the angel has already come for our particular crisis. Who was the angel? Oh, we should be calling, this in terms of questions now. All right, so, Brother Kuhn, you're here, yes. So, I would say, to solve our particular dilemma, it took an angel, but the angel's already come. And who was the angel? Exactly, he's already come. He's given us the record here. He's given it all to us. It's all set out in black and white for us here, and now we recognize it's perfectly valid what's said here. I mean, it fits us like a glove. It never did when I was younger. Nobody. The Book of Mormon, the missionaries pushed it as a romance. Tell us the story of the Indians and so forth. Red man, why do you always roam and so forth? It was a romantic novel. They almost took it that way. See, that was the appeal. It's a very different story today. Well, so, they're inspired, men inspired from heaven, it says. They're not angels and they're not, but they're inspired from heaven, inspired from above. And what was the reaction here? We've had Moroni here. The next verse tells us, many of the people were exceedingly angry, and chiefly the chief judges, and those were high priests and lawyers and so forth. And so, Sister Laver here? Good for Sister Laver. So they're, why would they get angry? Why would people, not just angry, but absolutely red hot, exceedingly angry. And who were they and why would they be angry? Why does this make, well, what was the reaction to Moroni? We said Moroni came. What were people mad at Joseph Smith for? And they were plenty mad at him, weren't they? They gave him an awful time from the time he was a kid, all right from the beginning. Well, what were they mad at? They weren't mad at him, they were mad at Moroni. If he didn't claim to see an angel, he wouldn't have been in any trouble at all, you see. It was the idea of Moroni coming that really set them on their ear, telling them that they were all wrong, they were on the wrong track, and so forth. What followed from that was devastating. They wouldn't take it. Well, this has happened all the time. Well, do you remember some other people who were given a bad time by the clergy and the scribes and the Pharisees and the lawyers and the elders? Yes. You see, you still, Sister Laver. Who? Abinadi was very good. Abinadi would. We'll give you a good for that. No, we're not marking this. Very good. Reminds me of the little kid that was in class, and the teacher says, what's 2 and 2, Johnny? And Johnny says, it's 4. She said, that's very good, Johnny. He says, good, nothing is perfect. Yeah. So here, Brother Lee, then, we go on here. Yes, is Terry Lee here? Yes, Brother Lee. Why would this particular class of people be angry? Why would they be upset? Notice it tells us what they were. They were the high priests and the lawyers. Well, that same question. Besides Abinadi, what other great prophet and teacher was given a bad time by the scribes and Pharisees and the elders of the Jews? 10 guesses, see? Of course, it was Christ. It was Jesus. They were the people that were always part. Nobody else. The mob was stirred up by them, remember? It says the people and the high priest and the elders came down and stirred the people up and said, Barabbas, and let Barabbas go. They wouldn't have done that. They wanted to let Jesus go, and so did Pilate. But the boys from the hill kept stirring things up, and they got what they wanted. Yeah, so this is the same sort of thing happening here, and we can sort of suspect. What do you think is behind this? Why would they act like that?
Because the prophets were being called again, preaching against.
They were preaching. What were they preaching against?
Iniquity.
They weren't. Well, iniquity is a very general thing. We're all against iniquity. Calvin Coover says. His wife asked him, "Where have you been? I've been to church." So what did the minister talk about? What did the sermon on? Said it was about sin. This is typical Calvin Coolidge, you see. Well, says Mrs. Coolidge, you know. What did he say about it? He's against it. It's like that. Well, everybody's against sin, so that can't be it. It's something more particular, something closer to home, isn't it? Yes?
They're threatening the foundations of things that they'd established.
Yes, their interests were being threatened, and their authority was being threatened and everything else. People don't like that. That's getting close to home, you see, this sort of thing going on. And we're open to that sort of thing today. Whew, are we? Well, we won't go into details there. What's wrong, for example, with working for clean air? Well, it threatens interests. It threatens practices. What arguments would the courts and the clergy raise here? What is the main argument against these prophets that come out boldly preaching? Like, notice, they're preaching boldly, and that's what the objection is, you know. They could have preached, they could have objected here and there, but they come forth and they speak up and they preach boldly, and they're against that. And of course, the argument is, what argument do you have against people going out and preaching? What's the usual thing we call them? What do we call such people? Troublemakers, nuisances, you see. Egon Friedel, a great writer in cultural history, says you have your choice of being one thing or the other. Everybody must be one or the other. You must either be a nuisance or you must be superfluous. Yes, you're just there. You're just a potted plant, as they say, nothing else. Unless you want to be a nuisance, and if you're going to do anything else, you have your choice and nothing else. So, there, say these people are nuisances, and I think that's quite adequate reason for getting rid of them, because they testify boldly. It's a thing you mustn't do. Well, now we see here in the 22nd verse, they couldn't do anything about it. There was no lawyer, judge, or high priest. They had a limit to their authority. What couldn't they do here? What was the limit on their authority in the 22nd verse here? Brother Lewis, Brother Russell Lewis, this is my way of calling it royalty. Well, Brother Madsen. Yes. Now, what was their... what didn't they have any control over?
There was a
limit of their authority, capital punishment. The laws of capital punishment were under strict control, you see. They had here, they had strict restrictions on capital punishment, the rule being that nobody could be executed without what? Without a warrant signed by the governor. Today, in our society, who can give pardons in our society? The governor and the president, the only two, just the top men. So we accept that part of it, they alone. But others can pass judgment. Judges, you see, can condemn people to death. Now, judges can, but they couldn't then, you see. It had to be the governor, which is the more sensible way, probably. We could talk about that. This isn't a political science class, but it's very significant here that this is the same thing we have as far as pardons go, or as reversing it. So they didn't like it, so what are they going to do about it? It sounds very, very familiar now. They're going to carry on, make it legal and so forth. How are they going to get around the troublemakers here? Notice the 23rd verse. They're going to engage in covert operations. They're going to do it. They have the power, they have the authority, you see, but this does not give them the constitutional right. Well, sometimes it's necessary to stretch the Constitution. These people are a nuisance, you see. We'll just get rid of them quietly, and then it'll be announced when it's over. Nobody will be the worse off. They can't do anything about it. Well, this is the typical covert operation, a thing into which we've drifted quite a bit in this country. And again, you see, this is a thing where the Book of Mormon is very, very relevant here. This is how they get around it, getting rid of troublemakers. Sometimes, as the delectable Miss Fawn Hall, it's necessary to stretch the law, to go beyond the law. Well, is it? But at any rate, there was a call for a grand jury here, an investigation. Things are beginning to look serious, you know. This sounds so modern, it's almost laughable. There's nothing like this to match it in Joseph Smith's day, as far as we know. But here they go. They were taken until after. Then the complaint came, see. Their complaints, and they're going to be indicted against the governor, against the judges. And they're going to be brought up and tried and probably convicted in the 26th verse. They were taken and brought up before the judge to be judged. So the trial is set. They're going to be tried. There's going to be a big front page news. This will be on all the evening news, believe me. To be judged of their crime, which they had done. Well, they weren't going to put up for that because it didn't look well for them. Notice it tells us here. They belonged to the statute. This was standard procedure. But what about the judges that were going to judge them? The judges who were going to judge them, they had connections with them. Does anybody know what the first rule of the law is? We seem to have forgotten it entirely in this country, but the first rule of the law, Roman law or anything else, is nemo dese judicat. Nobody can be judged in his own case. Of course, we do that all the time now. The executive now is judge. How often you see people, stock market people or anything else, or committees appointed, the committee does a complete bungle, and they investigate and decide that the committee has done a fine job. Well, who said so? Well, the committee said so. They passed it, and they should know. After all, they're the experts. This is the way it goes all the time. We're always getting these answers that are not an answer. They can put you off every time. And this is the sort of thing that's happening. No one knows how slick these people are. And there's a great deal said about this in the Book of Mormon. They treat this sort of sly crookedness, this off-color sort of thing, very skillfully in the Book of Mormon, and very clearly. And so the joke is, you see, that the judges themselves belong to the establishment. How are they connected? Well, family connections, lawyers or high priests gather themselves together. So what would you expect them to do, by calling their role? Brother McNary, is Brother McNary here? Good for Brother McNary. What would you expect them to do in this case? Now look, the judges are in, we know it, and as soon as they say something like kindreds and you say family, then what do you expect? It's not going to be just a government investigation, is it? Because they know each other. They're a closed group. They exchange with each other, see? This is an aristocracy, see? And how do they get to be, these kindreds get to be associated? Well, of course, by intermarrying. You get all this pride and wealth and so forth, and what do? You don't just go and marry anybody. You don't go marry somebody on the wrong side of the tracks. No, you build up a community like this sort of thing. And this is what happened, just like the Roman Patris. And so we have these kindreds. They're more than casual. And there's much of kindreds in the Book of Mormon, as you know. In our society, kindreds play a minor role. We don't have family organizations that way so much, unless you get into big corporations and things like that, where the family, the boss's daughter, G.G. White, wrote a book called The Organization Man some years ago that caused quite a stir on that very subject. You have to belong to be upward mobile in a corporation. In many corporations, you have to belong to the right church, belong to the right clubs, live in the right part of town, vote with the right party, and so forth, and marry the right people. So you get this close sense, and this is what you have here with these kindreds. But in ancient and modern society, in Western, the family is important. In the sagas, of course, every time you mention somebody, you say Egil. You cannot leave it there. You have to say the son of Thor, the son of Roknar, the son of Bautant, the son, and it goes down the list. You have to make a list of a family a mile long every time you mention anybody, because all the son, of course, in Scandinavia, we still say sons and sons and so forth. And in Israel, always Ben so-and-so, the Benny so-and-so, the sons of, the Bible is the patriarchal and genealogical. We're set with genealogy, you know. You have Ibn so-and-so and so. And of course, in the north, you have Mac, Macduff, Macbeth, and all the Macs we have. That means Mac, a member of the tribe, the great head, is actually head of a clan. So this is a clan organization, and Indian tribes have that completely. The basic organization of the Hopis is not the tribe at all, but it's the seven clans, the Bear Clan, the Eagle Clan, the Snake Clan, the Antelope Clan, and so forth. And it's the same thing in the Book of Mormon. You have the seven clans. They remain throughout, but they don't remain the government. They remain subdued. They're there, but they're the real basis of personal relationships. This is where decisions are made and so forth. If we look at Jacob 1:13, you see right in the beginning, that's the way they organized. And good old Jacob here, and he tells us here, now the people who were not Lamanites were Nephites. Nevertheless, they were called Nephites, Jacobites, Josephites, Azoramites, Lamanites, Lemuelites, and Ishmaelites. Seven different tribes representing seven different types of family. Ishmael was probably not of Israel at all. He wouldn't have been the servant of Azoram, or he wouldn't have been the servant to Laman. And Ishmael, with that name, remember Ishmael was the great rival of Jacob and Esau, Ishmael and the rival of Isaac, and Ishmael was a favorite Arab name. They'd be out there, and they had the Nephites and the Lamanites, and the Jacobites and Josephites. These are all sorts of people that were mixed in, because when they joined up, they had their family backgrounds, and they kept them. And it's the form of seven tribes. The very same thing has been shown by a German called, what was his name? He wrote a very good study on the ancient tribe that seven is the number of tribes to make it official. Well, for various reasons, just as we have 70 to represent the 70 nations of the earth and the seven presence of 70, they represent the normal distribution of the human race in sevens. But anyway, they have these tribes, and it's not the tribe, but the clan or fratry that really rules, and say among the Hopis, for example, they're ruled by women. Hopis actually, you'd think that they were anything but they're actually a matriarchy. The woman decides it. It's now Amina Lance's daughter who now holds the Hopi stone as the head of the... Because he's the head of the clan, that makes her the most influential there is. And the Bear Clan, I think it is. So, and we still try to revive it in industrial and landed dynasties. That's what the Wagner wrote The Ring about. The family, all these family... The troubles of families in the Ring of the Nibelung, you see, you start out and you have Siegfried who doesn't meet anybody who isn't his aunt until he's middle-aged and so forth. But it's all a family squabble, but it was represents very well, and it's been reproduced in Germany recently, as a 19th century industrialist family and so forth, something like, well, Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, the great German novel, Buddenbrooks, the family and the dynasty, and so we have dynasties and we have... the rest of them, they were very popular on TV a while back. So this is the way it runs, but we have supplanted by an aristocracy of birth. By what have we supplanted it? Aha, this is a good one. Brother McNary, you didn't have much of a chance. Well, Brother McNary is here. Yes, didn't give you much of a chance to answer. We're very proud that we don't have an aristocracy of birth anymore, but what do we have an aristocracy of? Which this is what we have here in the Book of Mormon. Remember here, this is what they were. Who the kindreds and so forth. What united them? What do we have an aristocracy of in this country? Yes?
Well,
Do-re-mi, sure, it's the money. That's exactly the whole thing. Don't you read Forbes regularly? As you should know, that's a regular dynastic, of course, in the Book of Mormon. That's the way it started out here, remember? Notice, the pride and boasting because of their exceeding great riches. Yeah, even the great, that was the basis of it. There were many merchants of them, and lawyers and officers. Well, there's your merchant class and lawyers and officers. The legal, that's exactly the setup that you would expect. It. Very advanced for Joseph Smith today, but that's the way they were doing it. And so, they... What are they going to do? Let's see if I'm lost here. They're doing the thing you're going to do, you see, the fratry rules. Incidentally, which is, if I may continue to ask you, Brother McNary, which is the more pernicious? Which is the more insidious? An aristocracy of wealth? We say that frees us, that liberates us. You just get the money, and then you're free to be as rich as you want. But which one has the more obligations? You've heard of noblesse oblige and so forth. Aristocracy of birth. See, Mr. Forbes says the prime responsibility, you see, in our society is to get rich. That's it, you see. But, and anybody can do that, so we're equal as far as that goes. But once you get it, you have no responsibility. You play around. He has how many hundred motorcycles, his balloons, his yacht. His many estates and castles all over the world and so forth. He just plays around, toys. He has a perfect right to do anything he wants with it. That's a Roman maxim, incidentally. But with aristocracy, you can't do that. You have noblesse oblige. There are certain rules you must obey. There are certain things you must do, you see. They don't always do them. They can be perfectly awful people, as far as that goes. Nevertheless, there are restraints there, whereas there are no restraints on wealth, you see. You can have anything in this world for money. So, what did they do here in the 28th verse here? They enter into a covenant. This is very serious. Now, a covenant means it's going further than just being relations. What would the nature of a covenant be, Brother Myers? What is a covenant?
Well,
Brother Myers here. Yes.
To destroy the government, to take down the chief judge, and destroy the rights of the people, and set up a king.
What does the word covenant come from? It comes from Latin convenire. It means meet at a certain place. Con means to come together, and venire means to come. You come together at a certain time in a certain place. You see, that's an appointment. And there you make an agreement. So that's what a covenant is. So they came together at a certain time and a certain place and agreed to set up a government within a government. The covenant would make them that, you see, even to covenant, yea, to combine against all righteousness. Well, righteousness is an abstract term. Who would ever want to combine against all righteousness? This is the way the editor reads it. But what is their program, you see? What does it mean by that? Well, the next one. They entered into a covenant to destroy them and to deliver them who were guilty of murder from the ground. Well, the whole thing was to liberate these justices, so they were to stop the trial, in other words. We're going to have this very serious trial, and they were willing to wreck everything just to avoid standing trial. We're not going to be tried by you people. Okay? So, in order to elude the grasp of justice, which was about to be administered to them. See, this is the thing. This, according to the Constitution, see, they were going to have to suffer the full force of the law, and they were going to use various ways of getting out of it. Well, we've seen the Iran-Contra. There are various ways of which people can get out of things. They try this, that, and the other. They stall and everything else. This is a more violent and direct, because they had had great advantage here, because they control most of the offices in the government. So they made them, and their program was to get rid of the people of the Lord while escaping the arm of the law, which nearly had them, you see. And so in the 30th verse, I miss Sister McNeely. Sister McNeely. So in the next verse, what happens then? And they made a covenant, and what was their final solution? What is the final solution here? To wipe them out, to destroy the government. It's going to be a pooch. See, what else do we call it? We call it a pooch. We call it a coup. They make it a coup. They're going to take over the government. Does that ever happen? It happens very often, you see. This is typical. This is happening here. And that's what they're going to do, it tells us. They had a covenant one with another to destroy the governor and establish a king over the land. Well, they'd always want it. Now, we know there are, that's the final solution. There were precedents for this desperate measure. And we say, we call it a coup or a putsch or something like that. And especially common in third world countries. We've seen it just happen in Panama. Imperial courts of Rome, but not just the small countries. Rome, Egypt, Russia, always. All the countries, Austria, were seething with plots and counterplots to overthrow the government. Well, you think before the French Revolution, you have the diamond necklace affair and all sorts of things. You have the Fronde. You have, way back in the time of Richelieu there, have these dangerous party intrigues to overthrow the government. Of course, the very famous story of Sanuha begins way back in the year 2000 BC. Just before 2000 BC, we have the story of, about 1985 BC. And the story to overthrow King Amenemhat, and his son heard about it when he was on an expedition in the desert. And there's a great intrigue that follows. Well, back there, it's a palace intrigue by some priests and lawyers who want to overthrow the pharaoh and put their favorite on the throne. They want a king. So this is an old story, actually. And what about the story of David and Solomon? Who was, now we're going to ask Brother Myers. You seem to be on the qui vive. Who did David have trouble with? You remember? Now, David was a king. He was a great king. But he had... Does anybody get after his throne? Is anybody after his crown, his throne? Got lots of trouble. Who was his son? Absalom, my son. Yes, Absalom was going to plot it against his father, and David had to put him to death. He didn't want him put to death by the powerful and brutal general. That's what happened. Then the general went down and intrigued in Arabia and got in all sorts of trouble. And as a result of that, Solomon had all sorts of intrigue. Well, you can imagine with 300 wives, he would have a lot of intrigue, but he did. And lots of it went on in Solomon's court. And then he was embittered and disillusioned. Then he wrote what we call Ecclesiastes in our Bible. It's called The Preacher and Other Things, in which he's completely disillusioned with the world. The whole thing is a mess. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He begins that way, you know. There's nothing to it. I've done everything. I've seen everything. Like the Roman emperor, like Septimius Severus, who was the principal author of the decline of the Roman Empire, as Gibbon tells us, on his deathbed. He'd been a sergeant in the army and ended up being an emperor, and one of the most powerful of all the emperors. And he said, omnia fuit, nihil expedit. I've been everything, and nothing's worth a damn. See, this is the way it goes. So we get these intrigues. Why do people act like that? Well, they do. They lack the gospel. Boy, do we lack the gospel. We could use it, couldn't we? There have been ambitious people in the church. After all, they made Joseph Smith's life a hell from the very beginning. 10 of the 12 turned against him and denounced him, so forth. Well, that's another story, but it's related to all this. So these plots, intrigues, and takeovers have been with us since the beginning of time. And we think of recent events, violent events, all sorts of things we do in going in, and Iran, Syria, things that happen everywhere. We won't go into, you don't need to, because it's all over the place today. Now, we got the seventh chapter here. Things are going to go happy there. What is the standard solution now preferred to the problem of taking over great power? How do we do it? You see, here it is, you see. They did destroy upon the judgment seat. What is the bottom line here that we get over? They say the average child before he begins school has seen 4,000 murders? It's the solution here. So what is the... is Brother Meese here? Oh, Sister Meese, excuse me, I'm sorry. Sister Meese, what is the final solution here? If you're troubled with a guy, what do? You rubs him out, don't you? That's what happens here. That's all you hear. You see the mafia. The mafia that was over KBYU. Very good report about the famous mafioso yesterday on how that's the way they solve their problems, and that's what they decide to do here. They did murder the chief governor of the land, and the people were divided, and notice what happens here, Sister Meese. After that, was the author of the Book of Mormon, incidentally, was he thinking of state rights or feuding over central versus local authority and so forth? Because they're going to have this problem now. They destroy the central government. Well, was this a living issue in Joseph Smith's day? There might be a Charleston in 1832 and so forth. But it was nothing like, it hadn't come out, of course. Because the book, this is all written 30 years before the Civil War, is what I'm trying to say. Those weren't issues then. But now Joseph Smith has this, the Book of Mormon has this breaking up. What are they going to do now that they don't have the central government here? Does it tell us here? How did they break up? Is Brother Morris here? Brother Morris, yoo-hoo. How did they, where's Brother Martin here? Yes. Now look at this second verse. What's going to happen to them? They destroyed the government, but did they just scatter in all directions, every man for himself? No. They had an organization already in place. They had an infrastructure already. It's been there all along. And what was that structure? It was the tribes. We saw that way back in Jacob, you see. They really went by tribes. They identified themselves. It doesn't talk about those authorities having any authority or government. It says they were called, they bore the names of their tribes. And you can be sure they bore them proudly. And they were rivals and this sort of thing. They've had them all along. So they have something to fall back on, and it's tribes. And they did destroy the government of the land. This is the main thing here. They actually got rid of their central government. Well, they're soon going to regret it bitterly, what they have done. But they... what was their objection to it, incidentally? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. Yes. Now, the result wasn't instant confusion, as we were just noting here, but immediately separating into tribes. And that implies, you see, that they were already in place and going. The tribal system was the infrastructure. And that's so with almost all American Indian tribes. You see, they have clans and fratries. They're the more important. They're your families, you see. But the tribals, we read in the third verse here that the tribes were already organized and appointed and had their chiefs already, and they became tribes now, independent tribes. And... do we have, what would happen if this country broke up like that now, Brother Morton? What do we have to fall back on? We already have 50, we have 50 governments, don't we?
We also have county governments.
Oh, would you fall back on county governments? Would that be our last resort? What do we have set up already? I read in the paper this morning that Brother Lee is arguing on behalf of the big stores that want to combine. He says he doesn't say there's anything, he doesn't approve of monopoly or anything like that. It's not the principle, it's a legal technicality. He says the states have absolutely no right to forbid them from forming a monopoly, the big supermarkets. He says only the federal government, for the federal government it's okay, they can do it. But the states can't do it. That's his only argument. You see, naturally he's doing it because he says he admits it'll force up prices and be hard on the commuter, on the consumer and so forth. But still we have the state's government. He doesn't want to recognize their authority in regulating prices at all. He says only the federal government can do that. Well, that's the big argument that's going on in the Supreme Court now. So don't phone over to President Lee. He won't be there for a while. But what about this business of the states? Would that be all right? Well, who had a good who had the idea that it'd be a good thing for the states to be independent? We talk about the sovereign state of Utah and so forth, while we giggle. Yes. Yes, but what? State's too big? Well, isn't the federal government a lot bigger than the states? I say, who wanted to? Who championed the cause of states governments that led to a great civil war? Ten guests. They were just a confederacy of states. They weren't a union. They were a confederacy of states, weren't they? Well, the Confederate States. That's what the Civil War was fought about. Who was to have priority, states or the federal government? Of course, it was the real issue with slavery. But that's what he fall back on here. And now, remember, this is written 30 years before the Civil War. This is he's not taking hints from the newspapers or anything like that. So every tribe appointed a leader here. And where do I have these here? Something here. It tells us there were no wars as yet. Well, why should there be wars among tribes? Would you think that a tribal organization would incline people to wars and... Is Brother Milstein here? Brother Milstein. Brother Oldham?
Yes.
Yes. What in a tribal society, society divided into tribes, would incline people to conflict?
I think, like we see in Russia right now, the Caucasus, the civil war.
Exactly. They have different customs. They're different families. In other words, the tribes, of course, the word tribus comes from the Roman word for the three. There were three main tribes that founded Roman to begin with. But each one keeps its language, each one keeps its dress, its customs, and so forth. If they don't have them originally, they develop them more and more. We do here, you see. Look, we're only 40 miles or so from the University of Utah, the same type of people doing the same sort of thing and so forth. But we develop different tribal mores, colors, directions, a totally different atmosphere at either school. It's a very interesting thing. Well, you can imagine with tribes that intermarry. Why would tribes be more inclined to intermarry than to cross-marry? What's the one thing that families, that notes family solidarity? What is it that makes family, for family solidarity?
I think it's the frame of reference. Everything's familiar to you.
It's yours, it's your pride, you see, right or wrong, my country, see, that's the whole thing. Yes, it's the pride, and would it tend to flatten out and become diluted with time, the tribes become less? Well, that's happened with states because of certain considerations, but on the other hand, then there are times when it comes right back just as bad as ever. There was a time when, in the 50s, state rights, all you see with the Confederate flag and so forth, all this sort of thing. Yes, the tribes are very inclined because they're family pride. We must be a little better than you, remember. Two families, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene. From ancient grudge break to new mutiny, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. That's the beginning of what play, Brother Paul? Brother Paul? Brother Paul is not here. Huh?
I believe it's All's Well Then As Well.
No, the Capulets and the Montagues, remember? So now you know what the play is. Right, you got it right. Give that man a cigar. All right. That's Brother Paul, of course. Yes, but notice what happened. From ancient grudge, fair Verona, where we lay our scene, is a very civil society, one of the most polished societies in the world was Verona. It was the queen of the Renaissance. I mean, it was a great place. And civil hands, and it was civility. The opposite of barbarism and tribalism is civility, is a civil society. It means city, of course. From ancient grudge, this goes way back to the early days, the families. From ancient grudge, break the new mutiny. These things are always breaking out, where civil blood makes civil hands unclean. They had no business killing each other just because they were different families, but they did. The play opens with this terrible brawl in the streets, and there's a murder and so forth. But the boys fight all the time. From out the faded realms of these two, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life and so forth. That's not the play today. At least today we can quote the closing lines of the scene of the play. The glooming peace this morning with it brings, the sun for sorrow will not show his head. go forth and have more talk of these sad things. Some shall be pardoned and some comforted, for never was a story more of woe than this of Juliet and her Romeo, Coitons. Yes. Well, so, but this is the situation exactly, the tribal. The families will have their pride. Do we have them? Oh boy, do we have some snobs in the church. Violin. I can tell you stories that would curl your hair as far as that goes. You wouldn't imagine how snobby some people can be, but we won't go into that, needless to say. So what's going to happen here? Now we come to a word that, the key word of the whole thing is right here in this sixth verse. Do you spot it, Sister Self here? Sister Self? Yoo-hoo. And Brother Shomwe. There's never a class without a Shomwe, but Shomwe has shown today. Smith, Sister Kyra Smith? Sister Smith? See, S's don't like to come. But then Mike Smith. See what I told you. And Brother Smock.
Yeah.
Now, Brother Smock, look at this. You see one word that really rings a bell there. What were they after? What was the object of the whole thing?
Just the instruction.
Of what? What's the word there that just hits you in the eye here?
The government, the instruction.
What is, in the verse 6, what's the word? What is the cloven hoof? What is the evil? What do we object to in big government and so forth? It sounds terribly mod here, just as modern as it can be. To say, that's maybe why I overlooked it, I suppose. Expect to be archaic, huh? What's the word? Regulations. Of course, we've got to get rid of these government regulations. The mafia hates government regulations. The big takeover artists hate government regulations. The monopolists hate them. The developers, the extractive industries, the polluters, they hate government regulations. They say our purpose is to get rid of government. And this, Joseph Smith is up to date, as today's newspaper says, they'd finally got rid of the regulations of the government when we're destroyed. That was what they were after, you see. Because of the secret they carried on their underground. Notice we would call this privatization. They took it for themselves, and out went the regulation. So happy, happy day. What were they supposed to regulate? Notice it tells us what they were supposed to regulate right here. The secret combinations and their friends and kindreds. Those were the very secret combinations which were not answerable to the government. They were therefore outlaws. And so the class and family system enabled these deregulators to operate more effectively because of the secrecy, the closeness of family ties. They could keep things to themselves. As we said, tribal societies are exclusive. They lead to rivalry and hostility, family pride, great inbreeding. You may read the terrible border ballads and so forth. What are some famous feuds in this country? The Jukes and the Callahacks, the Hatfields and the McCoys, and they just go, ignore all government, ignore everything else, completely concentrating on hatred of the other family, the other tribe. It's consuming till they destroy each other. This happened, you see, this mutual destruction. It's destroying the Book of Mormon. Remember the Jaredites? Remember the Nephites and the Lamanites? We're going to have them destroy each other here. Yes, and so we have people get rid of the regulations against insider trading or whatever it can be, and this makes it possible. We have the border ballads and they're nothing but bleak. They're terrible between the Douglas and the Percy and so on. Scott writes about them, Marmion and the like. Don't get me reciting border ballads here. There's some pretty bleak ones. Well, this accounts for the instability of the... There was great contention in the land, insomuch the more righteous part of the people had nearly all become non-existent as far as that goes. Wicked. They were no longer righteous. What happens to a righteous person who's become wicked? He disappears. It's, I suppose it's like to an electron that collides with a proton, and what you get out of it is they disappear. They both disappear, and you get a couple of photons or something like that. This great contention was inevitable. Was it between the righteous and the wicked? This is the point. Now, no, there weren't any wicked, righteous people around. They were hiding under the rock. No, there were hardly any. It was an extinct species, tells us here. Notice? Nearly all the righteous of all people, the more righteous part, had nearly all become wicked. But few righteous among them, they were not going to be heard, they didn't have a chance. Well, things are in a desperate situation now, you see. We're building up to something, you can see that. And so, Incidentally, are the righteous a threatened species today? Well, how do we know? Who determines whether they are or not, you see? It's going to be a very interesting problem. We think we're terribly righteous as far as that goes. Here, Ernest Wilkinson saying, we are holding the line in righteousness. Oh, boy. Now, and then he marvels at it. Then he marvels at it. And 6 years had not passed. See, he's as surprised as we are. Passed away since the more part of the people had turned from their righteous, and then it quotes the Old Testament pattern. They do that because that's the nature of a dog, and that's the nature of the sow, to wallow in the mire. Now, the secret combinations, this is an interesting thing here. They were not the same as the tribes, you notice. The secret combinations are not the same as the tribes, you notice here. They were those who had opposed the government before they broke into tribes and before the Pooch. They were the old king men. They had turned up, we won't have to review that. A large part of the Book of Mormon has been taken up with these king men with their pride and their nobility that Moroni says his purpose in life was to pull down the pride and nobility and the wealth of these king men. They're the aristocratic, rich, extreme right, and so forth. If it looks like an elephant, call it an elephant. And these are the hardcore king people, but they turned out to be a minority. They weren't the ones that overthrew the government. They're a minority against the tribes with their own leaders. And after it was too late, the rest of the people regretted what had happened. This is a terrible thing. They were not so strong with the tribes of the people who were united to save. They were united. What united them together? What united the people together? Brother Soa? Brother Soa here? On what would bring these jangling, warring... They weren't jangling, warring tribes. Their business was to get along. What would bring them together more than anything else? Not as tribes. That would keep them apart. It tells us in this verse what it is. Notice. They were not so strong as the tribes were strong, who were united together in what? I say, what united them? They united... Notice the bottom of the verse there. They were united in hatred. They had a common hatred. They hated the king men more than they hated each other. So that was their unity. That was their sacred bond, that they hated somebody else more than they hated that. And so, hatred of those who had entered into a covenant to destroy the government. They regretted it now. They said, those rascals are responsible for it. They wrecked the central government, and they hated them. They started making things pretty hot for them. So they would have to get out, you see. So they missed the central government, and so they hated each other worse than that. And we get an interesting setup here. As usual, the king men were joined by a steady influx of dissenters when they went out. This is the system that always happens. These dissenters, you find them all the way through the Book of Mormon, have an important aspect regarding race. Well, I see the time is up now. Maybe I have time for one more question. What about this 13th verse here about where the king went and so forth? Is Brother Steele here? Yes. Brother Steele, what's significant in this 13th chapter on a very basic question of the Book of Mormon? See, so speedy was their march, they could not until they'd gone forth to reach the people, and they went to the third place, and they went a long way, it tells us here. Now, the speedy, they could not stop them until they reached the, until they, out of reach of the people. See, they go out by themselves, out of reach, and thus ended the 30th year. Here you have a large group, going out, going far and fast, so they can't be reached again. Now, what's happening there? It's like a transplant of some sort, isn't it? What would happen when they went out there? They're out of tie and so forth. This casts a significant light on the race question in the Book of Mormon. Shows the sort of thing that's going on. They had this big country to go out in, and they would go out and settle there, and that's what they did, and then they would meet up with others and so forth, and this thing had been going on from the beginning. The result is you're going to get a very complicated race picture, racial mix, ethnic mix in the Book of Mormon. And why is that significant as far as evidence is concerned? What argument does that answer against, that's always been brought against the Book of Mormon? They say, look, everybody's a Nephite or a Lamanite. Do we believe that? Does the Book of Mormon preach that? The Lehi's people were the only people that ever went here? No. It gives us a very complicated ethnic mix here, and that's what we're getting here. And these things, there's a great deal about that in the Book of Mormon, which you overlook. These things are going on, these connections and so forth. How long does it take to make another race? Let's finish the book of, well, not 3rd Nephi now. We must finish down to the, yes. Well, the next, the 7th and 8th chapters. They're good. The seventh great Saturday. Again, look for then, what we're looking for now, as we've never looked for it before, is the parallels to the day we're living in now. Not only the events, but the atmosphere of it. You feel that it's coming home to you. This is dismally familiar. This is where I came in, you see. I wish it wasn't like this. It didn't used to be like this, but it is now. So, watch sharp.